I talk about the rational expectations thing, it's more of, I think, kind of in line with Bob Higgs when he talks about vulgar Keynesianism, and you know and I think this is sort of really with more vulgar rational expectations, a very simplistic view. I mean, I haven't gone into Muth, and I haven't gone really into Sargent or Lucas in that. I'd actually like to do more of it down the road because they do try to do things like bring in shocks and all that to the system. But nonetheless, as you can see, this is the famous proverbial. Every October we would get this, right? That Lucy would promise Charlie Brown that she would hold the football for him and he could go kick it. And of course, every year Lucy would pull up the football, and so every year she would rationalize it somehow. And that in the end, Charlie would believe her. This time he would trust her, and he'd run down to kick the football, and boom. Lucy would always pick it up, and there goes Charlie Brown. No, I did not get the copyright on that, so I hope nobody turns me in. I'm sure that's probably a federal crime worth at least 30 years in prison. But nonetheless, and so what I do is I first, if you remember Gordon Tullock's article, in fact, Walter had an answer to it years and years ago, and I've not used that in this, but I should have. I know Walter, but I know it just, but nonetheless, I'm aware of it. I just kind of ran out of time. But anyway, he says that Rothbard's apparent belief that business people never learn. Okay, in other words, this is the Charlie Brown problem. That the business people would be, they would have been misled maybe the first time, maybe even the second time, okay? But third time, they're not going to let Lucy pull up the football. And because they're going to say, Lucy, they're going to tell Lucy where to go because they're going to look at this, the Fed is lowered interest rates, and they're going to say, we know what's going on here, no problem. All right, so we're not going to take the bait, okay? And in fact, that would also be, to a certain extent, in the rational, remember, if you understand the rational expectations literature, it'd be like, I think that Hunter talked about earlier today, where they run deficits, but that did not lead to more savings. Remember in the whole rational expectations idea that, okay, the government runs, now people are going to, in order to pick up aggregate demand, but people are going to save more in order to avoid all that. So I think that this is kind of in line with that. Again, it's more of a vulgar. It's not the sophisticated technical stuff that you get from Lucas and Sargent and others. This is now Brian Kaplan. You got to go to Brian's website. And this is from Why I'm Not an Austrian Economist, and. But he says, what I deny is that artificially stimulated investments have any tendency to become malinvestments. Supposedly, since it cannot continue indefinitely, it's eventually necessary to let interest rates rise back to the natural level, which then reveals, a profit, which is what we, Austrians believe. Okay. Why would any businessman make his profitability calculations based on the assumption that low interest rates will prevail indefinitely? And no, that would happen. Entrepreneurs would realize that interest rates are only temporarily low and take this into account. Again, it's an RE point. In other words, in short, the Austrians are assuming that entrepreneurs have strange, irrational expectations. So, in other words, that the ATBC is actually an irrational thing. But, and even though I don't have it up here, and I look for it on YouTube, but if you remember that, one of the greatest movies ever made, Animal House, and that important scene there at the end where the band is trying to walk through the wall, and I forget the name of the character leads him into the wall. The only thing he said the entire movie was, he called Blutarsky a moron, and but his only line. But nonetheless, this is whole view that what we believe is that the band can really walk through the wall. And but then also Richard Wagner, okay. And I actually got this from Walter's article, okay. So I mean, it It ignores elementary requirements of rationality. Okay. In other words, that it's an irrational thing. Okay. But here's what I think is important. Okay. The situation might have had plausibility when the Austrian cycle theory was initially formulated. The collection of economic statistics was primitive. Central banks were committed to exchanging their notes for specie. There was no developed community of financial observers and Fed watchers. Now, I think this is really interesting as well, because what he's saying is that everybody else is going to look towards the same statistics that we do. Of course, notice that not a lot of economists figured out that we were in a housing bubble, even though they're looking at the same things. But again, what I want to try to do as much as possible is keep this in a systematic way, as opposed to stating the obvious, that they're saying that malinvestments can't happen, and they happen. And the reason I want to do that is because people often write about Say's Law. A couple of years ago, I did a presentation on Say's Law, and one of the assumptions was that with the Say's Law claims that recessions never can happen, which isn't true. I mean, and if you read that chapter, you can see that that's not true. But nonetheless, I want to avoid that particular problem. But nonetheless, I think what Wagner is saying is very, very important. All right. Now, then go on. He talks about we've been coming, looks about statistics, observers, and pundits are everywhere. Cycle theory that depends on inability of people to distinguish in the aggregate between increase in personal saving and increase in central bank holdings of government debt must be dismissed on the ground that it fails to incorporate any reasonable requirement of individual rationality and economic action. Okay. All right. And so, again, that he's saying, well, look, this stuff is available and we can all interpret these things, except for the small fact, of course, that people interpret these things very differently. And even when, even in hindsight, I remember, was it David Henderson and somebody else had that paper a while back that claimed that the Fed really hadn't done any artificial lowering of interest rates at all. And then there's always Paul Krugman. In other words, that what you have is a syllogism. All right, entrepreneurs, and if you want to put the major premise, entrepreneurs make rational decisions and generally are correct about business conditions. Some random errors are committed, because business information is readily available, entrepreneurs are able to make rational decisions. Okay. Furthermore, business decision makers are fully aware of the theory of rational expectations, or at least act as though they're aware of it. Even if they don't know the formal theory, their actions would imply that they're aware of it. Second, the minor premise, the ATBC requires entrepreneurs to be systematically fooled by economic conditions. Therefore, the ATBC requires irrational behavior by rational decision makers, which invalidates the Austrian theory of the business cycle. That's the, and I want to answer it. I mean, there's lots of ways to answer it. What I've done is, I've tried not to plow the same ground, I think, that Dempster and Carilli did back about 10 years ago. I think Bob Murphy did a paper, counter paper on that. And I actually have all those in my files. And I think, when I want to expand this paper, do some work on it, I want to bring all that in. This was much more of a hurried type job, but nonetheless, you've got to keep in mind, though, what they're saying first is that errors are irrational. Okay, that what they want to do is operate on the perfect information hypothesis, when in fact everybody, that hypothesis was counteracted by the mainstreamers 50 years ago with George Stigler in 1961. They have to admit that obviously entrepreneurs do make errors about the future, but what they deny is that they can make a cluster of errors. Except, of course, what do we see at the end of the boom and the beginning of the crisis? We in essence see evidence for crisis, for this cluster of errors. Okay. And now the question is why? Okay, I make a point here that entrepreneurs are not responding to economic theories. I mean, I guess a typical entrepreneur doesn't know who the heck Gordon Tullock or he might know who George Lucas is, but he doesn't know who Robert Lucas is. They respond to relative prices, all right? The other thing is that, and I bring this in my section called Time is of the Essence, that errors occur over time. And in fact, what's going on is that, in fact, in the system, that you can't tell the difference as an entrepreneur. You're looking at relative prices and present factors of production and what you would estimate to be future prices for consumer goods or those final goods that would be, you know, the lower order goods. And in the early stages, there's no way entrepreneurs can tell the difference. I mean, they're not going, you know, the number one, the typical entrepreneur is not a Fed watcher. Number two, the typical Fed watcher can't tell either. That's not something that the Fed watchers pick up automatically. It's not like the Fed, you know, hoists something out. You know, and in fact, that people are not even aware of the concept, you know, of a natural rate of interest. Okay, they can't tell the difference. Okay. And they assume, here's another thing, because, you know, in typical neoclassical economics, the use of time is such that it's compressed. If you look at a typical neoclassical model of the firm, whether it's a firm in imperfect competition or perfect competition, what do you assume? You assume that the process is instantaneous from the when you dig the first spade of whatever minerals out of the ground to selling the final product, that everything is compressed into that one amount of time. And, you know, I dealt with that, Murray dealt with that in looking at the whole issue of profit maximization, because, again, that you have to look at the issue of time. And I had a paper eight years ago, I guess, in the QJAE dealing with that. And when you bring real time into the model, however, that which is not done in your typical neoclassical model, what you're going to see are sets of relative prices that change over time. All right. What I call them, the vulgar RE critics are assuming that entrepreneurs face, okay, that, the other thing is that they also look into the issue of, they're looking, thinking of risk. And this is what I think Peter, and he's done a real service by really kind of resurrecting Frank Knight and his whole view of risk and uncertainty. And the other thing is that they're making the assumption that entrepreneurs face risks, and risks have real live numerical possibilities. And this way you can put them in mathematical form and have your nice symbols there. Okay, but Mies and others point out that, in fact, what entrepreneurs face is uncertainty. And this is important, too, because you not only have real time, but the issue of uncertainty is that you don't know what the outcomes are going to be. It's not, I have a whole set of outcomes, and here are the probabilities that if this is repeated over and over again, that this is what would happen. That instead what we have is uncertainty, all right, but the relative prices play out in real time. And so you have, you know, as I point out, that I think that what we have to keep in mind in this is that the criticisms, not only are they based on unreal assumptions, and a lot of neoclassical is very comfortable, of course, unreal assumptions, but the problem is that by ignoring both the issue of uncertainty and also the role of real time, that what the, and also for that, and really not understanding what entrepreneurs do regarding relative prices, that in fact that these critics actually get it wrong, that the ATBC can actually stand up against a view that entrepreneurs are making rational decisions. Thank you.